It is time right now for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David, of course, joins us on a Friday morning. He has his own terrific website, which is themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and it's always nice to have him around on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Well, hello there. Good to be with you again, reporting in from the media capital of the world. Always good to be talking with the always discerning Marshall Miles.
Well, the discerning Marshall Miles saw Mitch McConnell blink a little this week.
Interesting thought. The man blinks. Yes, he does. if you're a Trumpist, however, you might consider it was more than a blink. Trump and several other people who have been speaking out in support of him have been saying this week that it was not so much blinking as caving and collapsing completely, in other people's terms. He's agreed to a deal on the debt ceiling, that issue which is, as we know, periodically comes around and inevitably preoccupies both houses of Congress for often weeks at a time. It's happened, I don't know the exact numbers, but it comes out to being almost an annual event over the last 15 years or so. It's not edifying to see the legislative branch in this frame of mind. It's just squabbling and feverish efforts to find solutions to what are often the self-made problems. And this week, it's probably only a temporary solution, agreeing the agreement that's been worked out once the minority leader in the Senate agreed to the idea of an agreed rise in the debt ceiling only until December. Of course, it's just in time for it to be nicely tied in again with the equally perpetual argument over the totality of government spending, and we can of course see more. We can expect to see more partisan squabbling ahead, of course. But I would really like this week. You know, we always I say always. We quite often blow our special fanfare often for good pieces of journalism that we've located across the world. But we're totally outdone this week, out fanfared, if you like, by the biggest fanfare in the world, the Nobel Prize for Peace. The international award is announced this week as being shared between two journalists. So it's quite an occasion. Can we add our bugle fanfare, do you think, to the chorus of congratulations that's resounding around the world today?
We can absolutely do that. I say we can do that. Hang on a second here. I had it all set up to go, and of course, there, that's what went wrong. I have to do that.
This is live broadcasting.
That's the whole thing with live broadcasting. I think we can pretty much get to it right now. Why is it not coming across? I can't tell you why it's not coming across, but for some reason it's not functioning this morning, David.
Well, the spirit of the fanfare is here anyway, because the prize goes to, and the fanfare, if we had it, goes to Maria Ressa in the Philippines and Dmitry Muratov in Russia. Both of them dedicated campaigning journalists, campaigning against corruption and oppression in their respective countries. It's worth noting that the newspaper that Dmitry Muratov founded, people phone into him with lots of stories, the Novaya Gazeta, it has, under President Vladimir Putin, had six of its reporters killed for their work. And over in the Philippines, Maria Ressa has been targeted for constant harassment by the Filipino president, Rodrigo Duterte, in many ways a similar leader to Vladimir Putin. Maria Ressa, by the way, is only the 18th woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize in 126 years. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? She founded the online outlet Rappler, which is doing great work in exposing the malfeasance of the president and the corruption that happens right through the fabric of the Filipino government. The Nobel Committee's citation says that the two journalists, let me quote them directly, their courageous fight for freedom of expression, which is a precondition for democracy and lasting peace, is what has earned them this award. They are representatives, the committee says, of all journalists who stand up for this ideal in a world in which democracy and freedom of the press face increasingly adverse conditions. So that's a first. I believe it's a first. I don't think there's ever been a Nobel Peace Prize awarded to journalism. To journalists for their journalism. So I think it's well worth noting this week.
And I think I think journalists need that as a shot in the arm, because the previous 4 years they have been berated and put down. So a lot of people don't trust media, and that's a shame, because yeah, there's some bad eggs on in the media, but mostly these are people that are vastly underpaid for the amount of work they actually have to do. It's to be in the national media today is absolutely one of the hardest jobs I think you can find.
Yeah, and don't forget that we are still, nonetheless, one of the better countries in the world for press freedom. I mean, I'm not going to toot the horn, as it were, even though we don't have our horn today to toot for American journalism in an unqualified way. I mean, we spend a lot of our time in this slot, for instance, finding fault with it, and so we should. I mean, we're discerning customers of the media. We have the same right as every reader and viewer and listener to work out what it is about the journalism we're offered that is wrong and mistaken and tilted and unfair. But on the whole, American journalists have it pretty easy compared with some. I mean, the Nobel Committee is absolutely correct to say that democracy and freedom of the press are increasingly facing adverse conditions, and that applies around the world. That's their canvas, of course. This is a completely international award. They review possibilities, candidates, if you like, for the award from every single one of the 194 nations in the world, and they've decided this time upon Russia and the Philippines as instances where freedom of the press is under threat, and they've singled out these two examples of doughty fighters for freedom of the press. And I'm not going to say it's long overdue, but it's a well-timed announcement and a well-timed award.
Well, speaking about the press, something interesting has developed this week. A lot of books have come out about the Trump presidency and what happened after the election. And now the report from the Senate Judiciary Committee finds that a lot of the things we heard that sounded just unbelievable are absolutely true. That one, Donald Trump tried 9 times to get the Justice Department to undermine the election. There also was a meeting in the Oval Office where Trump tried to put a plan together where he would put a young attorney general as a loyalist to overturn the election. That was blocked, thank God, because people talked about the move, saying it would trigger a mass Justice Department resignation. Trump really basically out in the open saying that he would try to assert his executive privilege to prevent the House Select Committee now from probing the January 6th event by holding back information. I mean, these are amazing stories from a former president of the United States.
Yes, the scene painted by the committee's report of what went on between former President Trump and the top officials of the Justice Department. He would say his Justice Department. He was treating the Department of Justice as simply an extension of his own power, or trying to do that anyway, and it was only checked in doing that. You know, one of our actual checks and balances, much vaunted in American democracy. The check and balance, and in this case, being the officials of the Justice Department themselves, who said, as a body, that they would all resign if he did replace the then Attorney General Rosen with his placeman, Jeffrey Clark. The tale of two Jeffreys. Jeffrey Rosen was temporarily the head of the Justice Department as the Attorney General, replacing another Trump placeman who had to go because Trump was dissatisfied with him, and even this new placeman had the courage, along with many of the staff members who came to his support in that moment, to say that they would all go, they would resign en bloc if Trump went ahead with his interference, in this case, placing another Jeffrey, the more junior Jeffrey, because he turned out, although he was a gray, unknown figure in the department overall, but he turned out to be something of a Trumpist, not just something of a Trumpist, but a legal officer who was prepared to do these highly illegal steps that the president wanted taking to ensure that the Biden victory was overturned by hook or by crook. And of course we know now, and we knew at the time that it didn't happen. We now know in full detail how it didn't happen. It was stopped by even sympathetic members of the Justice Department who were in many ways until this moment followers of Trump, deciding that this was a step too far and they just couldn't do it. So I suppose we should be grateful for them, though it's very worrying that it got as far as it did, and I think that's the overall message of the report. Indeed, the chairman of the committee made it clear that this was a case of democracy surviving just by a squeak.
And I'll just one more story about Donald Trump that I find amusing. He started to rant and rail against Forbes as Forbes came out with their annual list of the 400 richest people in America. And for the first time in 20 years, Donald Trump is not on that list. And so,
well, I guess the best way to ensure Trump's ire is to suggest that his ego is misplaced. And it's an interesting thing to find that the trigger is so easily pulled and achieves its aim so easily. Take him off the list of the great and powerful, and he's of course furious. How could anyone, least of all Forbes, demote him in any sense? And I guess that was guaranteed to be on the front pages when Forbes made that decision. I suspect it was done with a certain amount of glee. I mean, they're all journalists at Forbes, after all, and I think they knew what would make headlines. That change in Trump's status was bound to do it.
All right. Another story that's been I've been meaning to talk about, and we really haven't discussed it much, and that is, and this is a far bigger problem than most people. I don't think even people realize, most people realize that this problem exists, and that is China and Taiwan. This is a real big deal if this goes south. This is a real big deal.
Well, sure. I mean, the China-Taiwan conflict, I mean, it's not become an open conflict in the sense of open warfare, but it has tread very close to that point many times over ever since the end of the Second World War. Taiwan is in a curious position. It was where opponents of Mao Zedong fled to escape as he was taking over completely the Chinese Communist Party under Mao Zedong. And mainland China, it took some time, of course, but it has become the recognized government for all of China, and it regards Taiwan as a breakaway province on its own island. And the fight over recognition for each of those countries, and I mean, it tilted completely. As history went on, Taiwan is now the underdog fighting for recognition, while previously it was the communist-led China that found it difficult to get itself recognized internationally. Now the boot is on the other foot, and boy, is it a jackboot in the case of mainland China under communist control. The extraordinary things being done. Fleets of fighter aircraft being sent to Taiwan airspace to buzz them, I guess, screech in towards the country and then veer away only at the very last minute when they approach Taiwan airspace. It's clearly a campaign of harassment, and of course, while it's there's no official recognition for Taiwan internationally in the sense that it does not occupy the China seat in the United Nations, as it used to do, but it certainly has the backing in practice and often in open rhetoric too, from America's successive administrations. And so, yes, it's got to a very high point right now, and a very intense point, and it's troubling for the world as a whole. And of course, the bullying tactics of communist China, not just against Taiwan, but in that China Sea area altogether, it has been a real provocation in international terms generally. It's at the heart of the recent conflict amongst allies on our side, if you like, of this controversy. The agreement that embraced Australia, an agreement between the United States and Britain, took in Australia too, in a new determination to confront China in a way, and support Taiwan in the process with a nuclear agreement, which of course disconcertingly cut out France, who thought that they were in the loop for doing a submarine deal with Australia, conventional submarines, not nuclear ones. But now the agreement is nuclear, and the stakes, generally speaking, are just getting higher and higher in this troubled and conflicted part of the world.
And talking about submarines, I'm not sure if you're aware of this yet, but the USS Connecticut hit something in the South China Sea the other day. It injured 11 sailors. They're going to be okay. They don't know what it was. But this comes up once again at a time where tensions between the U.S. and China are really almost like it used to be with the U.S. against Russia many, many years ago.
It resembles a Cold War, that's true, and a ship, in your precise words, when it hits something, that can be a trigger. So many celebrated and unfortunately sometimes terrifying moments of history have hung upon a collision at sea or some incident, a maritime incident that triggers complete open hostilities, and it hasn't happened so far in the South China Sea in this current situation. But of course, the current situation is really undeniably tense.
Well, there's a lot to see and do. What do you think about the split, the Democratic Party? I mean, it appears to be almost open warfare between Bernie Sanders and Manchin. I mean, the Democrats really have
interests. I suppose we should call them. As I've suggested one or two times when we've talked, I don't like the journalistic term that's often used in this argument, in the descriptions of this argument that goes on forever in the Democratic Party, between what are called progressives these days on the one hand, and what are so-called, and this is the term I don't like, so-called moderates in the Democratic Party, especially in the Senate. Excuse me. It's a tension and a debate that goes on all the time, of course, in the Democratic Party, and it's come to a head now because it affects the math of in ensuring passage in the Senate, especially, but overall in both houses of Congress, when it comes to the Biden administration's very considerable and extraordinary. Really large items of social spending, other kinds of spending too, but not least of all, of course, infrastructure and the measures to counter climate change. But the difference of opinion between the two wings of the Democratic Party on Capitol Hill are, of course, perpetual fodder for journalism, and we're seeing it portrayed now as the battle that it is. But of course, journalism, being what it can be, often gets really overwrought about differences of opinion and wants to use the language of warfare. There is a battle going on, we're told. That could be the case, but I think it's probably fairer to say that these are deep differences of opinion, and people are standing up with whatever. I'm not going to use the word weapons. Whatever tools that are at their hand for ensuring that they get their position registered, as opposed to the other side in this argument, and inevitably, it comes over as. The word I use for it so often is squabbling. It's unfair, but it's probably describes the process of to give it a more dignified label, democratic discussion.
And just to throw this in, seeing as Afghanistan and the U.S. Now is in the past, and people tend to move on and forget about it. But to show really why the move to leave Afghanistan was eventually the right move is, once again, there was an explosion in a mosque in northern Afghan, and the civil war continues inside that country between all the power brokers and even the Taliban. And now we can sit here and look at this and realize that there's just nothing right now that can bring that. The country's never been together. I don't know how people look at it any other way. It's just a country that is going to be separate because it's so big and so undeveloped.
Well, the Taliban have taken power. Whether that means they have control is an entirely different question. And it quite clearly, from the incidents that have been happening, the Taliban has not got complete control of the country in any way. And it is perfectly arguable, as you're suggesting, that the entire country is incapable of being controlled. People don't have the measures by which rule can extend in any full and complete way. Clearly the Taliban's biggest thorn in their side, if you like, is the local version of ISIS. ISIS-K is the abbreviation for it now. And they appear to be behind some of the outrages that have been happening, the bombings that take the lives of civilians again and again, just as before. Sometimes the Taliban is responsible for that kind of attack. Sometimes it was other forces under the control of other local warlords, Afghanistan as a whole is hardly at peace. A long way from getting into a state of national and broadly accepted peace. And the country is continuing in turmoil, and I can understand why many Americans would say we're well off to be out of it now. But that doesn't absolve us of responsibility for all those people whose the risk of whose lives is entirely still to be laid at the door of Americans who encouraged them to think that democracy and freedom was possible. And all the people who were employed by the Americans in that process are now at greater risk than anybody else in Afghanistan, and they're not all out, despite the massive airlift that there was, and how America is intending to actually exert its responsibility and take good care of those people to whom it owes so much is still a very, very open question. What's called in the trade now over the horizon actions to extract these vital allies of America is still to be seen, and I suspect that there's going to be a lot of disappointment amongst those who want to see the Afghans treated fairly, who did so much to promote American policy in Afghanistan over 20 years.
And a final comment from you, David, on YouTube. YouTube has decided to remove all anti-vaccine misinformation. Now, at first glance, it appears to be a little scary down the slippery slope of controlling media. But when you come right down to it, I just think that these organizations in social media, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, should just forget about just anti-vax information. Just take off anything that's misinformation. I mean, that is proven to be wrong. I mean, that to me doesn't sound bad.
Well, you won't find a journalist ever comfortably supporting the idea of censorship, and I don't, and won't ever. But in the case here that you're talking about, YouTube, and one hopes other social media platforms too, following suit, dismissing as a piece of editorial policy what they see as, and I think all of us would probably agree on it too, all reasonable people I think would agree in the case of the vaccination issue, that disinformation needs to be excluded, and deliberate faking of the facts, that's beyond the pale. And it comes into that category of free speech that was defined so long ago now, that we have, of course, the freedom of expression, but we don't have the freedom of expression that extends to shouting fire in a crowded theater. There are some things that are simply not allowed simply because it's too dangerous, and in this case we're talking about public safety.
David, it's always great to talk with you. We'll speak with you again next Friday.
I look forward to that.
David Terechuk with The Media Beat. Once again, you can find David at his website, themediabeat.us, and also robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Terechuk.